This is a podcast based on some talks that I've done recently. A few weeks ago, we hosted a party of Buddhist monks. Something one of them said made me realize the importance of reconciliation at this time. Actually, it's also an important idea for all time. We have the need for reconciliation between nations, between cultures, between religions, between peoples. The need for reconciliation in politics, in culture wars, in economics, in society is very obvious. There's a need for reconciliation also between humanity and the environment, the planet. There is a need for reconciliation within our communities, our friendship groups, our families. And as human beings, there is a need for reconciliation within us, between our minds and our bodies. Often I think we're out of whack, even within ourselves. Sometimes our minds don't serve our bodies, nor do our bodies serve our minds. And most important of all, there is a need for reconciliation between our minds and our bodies and that greater spirit that's at the center of the universe. The purpose of many religions is to enable that reconciliation to take place, of human beings trying to propitiate the God or gods with their behavior. The whole of the Christian religion is really an attempt to make humans right with God. Jesus is supposed to have come to reconcile man to God. Some say his death was an act of propitiation. He died for our sins, all that stuff. Now, I wouldn't necessarily go along with the idea that there is some angry God out there who we have to make like us. But I would say that as humans, we have to reconcile ourselves with the struggle that we have with our lives and therefore with the essence of all things. Thich Nhat Hanh says, the Heart Sutra says that there's nothing to attain. We meditate not to attain enlightenment because enlightenment is already in us. We don't have to search anywhere. We don't need a purpose or a goal. We don't practice in order to obtain some high position. In aimlessness, we see that we don't lack anything, that we already are what we want to become, and our striving just comes to a halt. We are at peace in the present moment, just seeing the sunlight streaming through our window or hearing the sound of the rain. We don't have to run after anything. We can enjoy every moment. People talk about entering nirvana, but we're already there. Aimlessness and nirvana are one. That's a description of reconciliation between ourselves and our lives. So you can see the extent that reconciliation is the key to unlocking a peaceful world. The word reconciliation comes from the Latin root re, re, which means back, and conciliare, which means bring together. So reconciliation means to bring back together. And the first, obviously, interesting thing is that we're not just bringing things together, we're bringing them back together, which means that whatever it is that's being reconciled was originally together, then became apart, and then is brought back together again in reconciliation. And that's obviously where the difficulty arises, because you have to come from a place that says that once we were together, then we're split, and then we have to be brought back together again. And it's difficult because in the case of humanity, it involves things like forgiveness and compassion. In forgiveness, we have to give over the hurt that we have, to forgive it, to let it go. And to do that, we have to have compassion, the compassio, the feeling with another who we're being reconciled with. That's difficult on the level of individual relationships. And it becomes even more difficult when it becomes to groups and nations. But it is possible. Look at the change in relationships with both Japan and Germany since the Second World War. We've been reconciled. We've been brought back together again. And that has involved forgiveness and compassion. It's also involved truth, which is why truth is such an important commodity. Without truth, we can't have reconciliation. Look at South Africa's Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Through telling the truth, both compassion and forgiveness were possible, and what would have been bloodshed was avoided. And that's why truth is so key in our ability to create reconciliation between ourselves politically, culturally, and socially. We can't forgive or be compassionate if we're not able to witness the truth in a situation, which is why people often make it difficult for us to find the truth. If there is an obfuscation around the truth, it's a sure sign of an intent to control. We don't want this or that truth revealed because we're not looking for reconciliation or compassion or forgiveness. We have another agenda, and that agenda is to steer in a particular direction, irrespective of what the actual truth is. Look at the way dictators try to control our media and free speech. They don't want the truth because their agenda is to control rather than reconcile. But without reconciliation, there can be no peace, only the struggle between competing agendas. And dictators are very unwilling to admit that they're not looking for peace or reconciliation. They're not willing to admit that what they want is domination. They think that you can dominate your way to peace. However, they don't realise that this peace through domination or peace through strength, as the Orwellian picture paints it, is in fact an oxymoron. You can't have peace through strength, because the very violence that you're exerting through your strength will never bring the peace that's looked for, which is why dictatorship will always end in failure. That lovely phrase from Gandhi, "When I despair, I remember that all through history, the way of truth and love has always won. There have always been tyrants and murderers, and for a time they can seem invincible, but in the end, they always fall." Think of it, always. Which is why both Gandhi and Dr. King were right. Nonviolence is the only answer, because it can reveal truth, lead to compassion and forgiveness, and therefore produce that reconciliation that ends the struggle. To end the struggles, we have to have reconciliation. All the great peace solutions begin with reconciliation. And where there's no reconciliation, the struggle flares up again, which is why the First World War led to the Second World War. We wanted to punish Germany by ruining their economy, and the result was the rise of the Nazi Party. As we look into our world today, the only way that conflicts will be resolved is through reconciliation, and where one or both parties will not be reconciled, the struggle will carry on. Russia and Ukraine have to tell the truth to one another about their fears, their hurts, their problems. Then there has to be compassion, one for the other, and then the forgiveness which will lead to peace. It may sound far-fetched, but it has to be that way, and it will be that way eventually. In Korea, you can see the border as a clear example of a lack of reconciliation, where there is no truth, no compassion and no forgiveness. Therefore, the struggle continues. In Northern Ireland, in South Africa, in Colombia, after the Second World War, we had truth, compassion, forgiveness and reconciliation. That may not hold and could flare up again, but you can see the difference. And to some extent, here in America, you can see the echoes of the Civil War in the culture wars we have today, where in some cases, there's not been reconciliation, and the struggle continues. I've always said that on a world stage, the only answer is global citizenship, where all nations become reconciled to each other, where truth is told, where there is compassion for each other, where there is forgiveness, and where we're reconciled, we're brought back together again with the earth as our home, and the recognition that all humanity are of the same family. Now, you may think that this kind of world peace is only fit to be aspired to by Miss World competitors. However, it will come eventually. Even if it's 200 or 300 or 400 years ago, we will have to come together in this way in order to survive. Which brings us to our reconciliation with the planet, surely the most important issue in the modern era. Whatever we can do to each other in wars is nothing to what the planet can do to us if we're not mindful of it. We have to become reconciled to our planet, or it will destroy humanity in order to preserve its own survival. And that process is the same. We have to tell the truth about how we've pillaged and raped our planet for our own needs. We have to have compassion on the planet, to feel with its pain, and we have to forgive ourselves enough in order to act together and so turn a corner. But we don't tell the truth. We make it about jobs and the economy, about politics and culture wars, about wokeness and socialism. Anything but tell the truth that our behaviour is despoiling our home and that soon it will become uninhabitable. We have to tell the truth to each other now about that to give us time to generate the compassion and forgiveness that we will need to make the changes that must happen. Without reconciliation with the planet, we have no future. In all these cases, reconciliation produces symbiosis, the interaction between two different organisms living in close physical association, typically to the advantage of both. Our nations need to develop these symbiotic relationships in order to be able to create a right relationship with the planet and therefore prosper. So we have to be reconciled as nations so we can be reconciled with the planet. And in order for that to happen, we have to be reconciled within ourselves as individuals. We have to strive not to be right and to control, but to tell the truth and forgive through compassion. And that includes our families, where we're often unwilling to tell the truth, have compassion and forgive. Our friends, our work colleagues, our communities. Where we don't feel reconciled, we have to tell the truth about it to ourselves and be open to that reconciliation taking place. Now, it's not always appropriate to just go up and blurt to someone all the things that we're not reconciled about. Often that'll just exacerbate the situation. But if we've told the truth to ourselves of not feeling reconciled and have some handles as to why that might be, and if we hold ourselves open to reconciliation, then the opportunity just might come along where the truth might be welcomed by the other and compassion might lead to forgiveness and reconciliation. Our part is to be open to that, to be willing for it to happen, and to be prepared to be vulnerable if this opportunity arises. This means telling the truth to ourselves about our relationships, people who we feel that there is still something out there that needs to be dealt with, where there's still a space where there needs to be a bringing together, and we have to be willing to take advantage of any opening we're given. In reconciliation, the willingness is all. If we're willing, then the means can appear and we can take advantage of it. This is so needed in our families, our friendship groups, our work environment, within our communities, our politics, our culture, our religion, and our nations. But first and foremost, there is the reconciliation with ourselves that we have to deal with. We often struggle just to get physically comfortable. We struggle with our circumstances, with our friends, with our families. We struggle with what we want to achieve within our lives. We struggle with getting old. We struggle with death. All those struggles will only stop if we're able to become reconciled with the cause of those struggles. We have to tell the truth about those causes. We have to have compassion on ourselves and others. We have to forgive, literally, to give back the hurts. And that all starts within. It starts with the innermost part of the innermost bit of our being. If you have a spiritual practice, that's where the work begins. And the first thing we have to reconcile is our minds and our bodies. The mind and body have to be reconciled and brought back together again in the stillness of the present moment. The mind has to let go of its wonderful ideas and just be in the body with the breath or the mantra or whatever is the focus of your spiritual practice. And the body has to become at peace with itself, not fidgeting to get comfortable, but reconciled to itself and reconciled to the mind, even with the discomfort of sitting still. This is the first step of inner reconciliation, the mind and the body coming together and being at peace, which then opens up the second point of reconciliation, which is the reconciliation of the mind and the body to the present moment. Once the body and mind are still, then we can fully enter into the present moment. In fact, we're reconciled with the present moment. We're brought back to our true home. Thich Nhat Hanh says, "Our true home is the present moment. To live in the present moment is a miracle. The miracle is not to walk on water. The miracle is to walk on the green earth in the present moment, to appreciate the peace and beauty that are available now. Peace is all around us in the world and in nature and within us. It is in our bodies and our spirits. Once we learn to touch this peace, we'll be healed and transformed. It's not a matter of faith, it's a matter of practice. We need only to find ways to bring our body and mind back to the present moment so we can touch what is refreshing, healing, and wondrous." The second step is that reconciliation with our true home. It brings both power and healing, and it opens the portal to the third step, which is the experience of oneness with all that is. Evelyn Underhill described mysticism as the art of union with reality, and that's the third stage. Bede Griffiths, the English mystic, said, "The goal of each religion is the same. It is the absolute transcendent state, the one reality, the eternal truth, which cannot be expressed, cannot be conceived. This is the goal not only of all religion, but of all human existence. Whether they like it or not, all men and women are continually attracted by this transcendent truth. The mind, in and beyond every formulation by which it seeks to express its thought, is in search of the absolute. It is made for being, for truth, for reality. It cannot rest satisfied in any partial truth, in any construction of the human mind. It is always being carried beyond itself to the ultimate truth." To enter into this ultimate is to give up the struggle that we have to discover the reason and meaning in our lives. It's just to be in that ultimate truth. Jesus expressed it perfectly when he said, "I am in the Father, and you are in me, and I am in you." That is the state of oneness with all, with the divine nature, the Father, with all that's out there, you, and all that's within, me. We practice that level of reconciliation when we meditate, when we undertake our spiritual practice. We reconcile ourselves to God and all the universe. That ultimate truth is the starting point. The starting point because it gives us trust. Trust that in the end, all will be well and all manner of things will be well. And if they're not well, it's not the end. That peace at the center, that trust that we're all held within an ordered universe, gives us the confidence to move outward in love, to give with no expectation of return. Thich Nhat Hanh, "We meditate not to attain enlightenment because enlightenment is already in us. We don't have to search anywhere. We don't need a purpose or a goal. We don't practice in order to obtain some high position. I'm able to do what I do, to live my life the way I've lived my life, because I have trust that I am within a consciousness that has a much greater wisdom than I could ever have. And that consciousness is a loving consciousness that is unfolding towards an ultimate good. And if I'm able to open to that consciousness within me, then I can bring love to whatever circumstances come my way. I can give with no expectation of return, because I'm living in love, and there is no greater return than to live in love. But just to bring it back a little, we begin by reconciling our minds and our bodies. Then we reconcile ourselves to that portal of the present moment, which opens us up to reconciliation with that ultimate reality. That is the reconciliation that occurs as part of our spiritual practice, and it's that which guides our actions in the world. But it is difficult to maintain that level of awareness in our lives when we have to put food on the table and deal with whatever comes our way. And yet we can practice this deep level of reconciliation, and that leads to us coming from a place of reconciliation as we live our daily lives. Because in living our lives, we mirror what's going on in our practice. And it begins with the reconciliation of our minds and our bodies in our everyday life. We like to feel good. Our minds like to feel good. Our bodies like to feel good. However, we can't feel good all the time. In his book, Cultivating Aliveness, Christian Dillo says, "Cultivating aliveness is commonly equated to the pursuit of happiness, the desire to feel good, preferably all the time. Who doesn't want that? The reality, however, is different. Pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral sensations come and go. What's more, we can only experience pleasantness in the contradistinction to neutrality and unpleasantness. So if we want to experience more of the good stuff, paradoxically, we need to welcome more of the bad stuff too. In contrast to the pursuit of happiness, being fully alive is not about feeling better, it's about feeling better." In other words, we have to reconcile our desire to feel good with the fact that we feel both good and bad. And we have to be willing to accept both, not always be enslaved by our desire to feel one thing or another. That's the body and mind becoming reconciled to the reality of the feelings that life brings with a desire to feel good all the time. And linked with that is the attachment that we have to particular outcomes. We want life to go our way, but that doesn't always happen. Somehow that has to be reconciled. Which is why Thich Nhat Hanh talked about aimlessness. In aimlessness, we see that we don't lack anything, that we are already what we want to become, and our striving just comes to a halt. We're at peace in the present moment, just seeing the sunlight streaming through our window or hearing the sound of the rain. We don't have to run after anything. We can enjoy every moment. People talk about entering nirvana, but we are already there. Aimlessness and nirvana are one. This is the reconciliation between what our minds want to happen in life and what actually happens. For us to experience the peace that reconciliation brings, these two things have to be brought together. And the way we do that is to give up our attachment to the outcomes that we want to have in our lives and remain in the present moment that's our home. So we reconcile ourselves to the feelings that come our way, and we reconcile ourselves to the circumstances that come our way. That's a mirror of the reconciliation of the stillness of the body-mind during meditation, and our entering and choosing the present moment in meditation and all that brings. This is how we prepare ourselves to be agents of reconciliation in the world. By first being reconciled within ourselves, reconciled to our feelings, and also to our circumstances. And you can see how that leads to freedom. Freedom to be, to love those around us, to give with no expectation of return. Free to experience ultimate aliveness without being enslaved to a feeling or a set of circumstances. And we take that into the way that we approach our lives. We become reconciled to our circumstances, to the hand that we've been dealt, because we know that we're a part of something that has infinite wisdom and will enable us to use what we have as a winning hand, even if it's only a pair of fives. That doesn't mean we don't strive for the best. This is not about giving up. It's about striving for the best, but not being fazed by the outcome of our striving. We're striving with no attachment to the outcome. As the Tao Te Ching says, we do our work, then step back. All of which puts us in a place where we can begin to reconcile the world around us. Therefore, the master acts without doing anything, teaches without saying. Things arise and she lets them come. Things disappear and she lets them go. She has but doesn't possess, acts but doesn't expect. When her work is done, she forgets it. That's why it lasts forever, to quote the Tao Te Ching again. We have to become reconciled to our lives and our deaths. As part of our inner work, we have to reconcile ourselves to our non-existence as well as our existence. And now is the time to do that, rather than when death is bearing down on us. And if we're reconciled to our deaths, then we become reconciled to time, to being in the present moment, which is the eternal now, and includes both the past and the future. In reconciling ourselves to our deaths, we do the profound work that enables us to live in this moment, rather than be dreading the ravages of time on health, aging, and non-existence. Now, I'm not saying we have to do all this stuff straight away, but if we are to be truly at peace and reconciled with our lives, and therefore an agent of reconciliation for others, then these are the things that we have to be considering. These are the things you have to be working on in your daily practice. Not to work on yourself in this way is to present yourself to life as damaged goods that can only go so far as a force for good, a force for transformation. But if you do this work, then you have the opportunity to make a difference and to enable reconciliation in others. Because you're not acting out of other agendas to feel a certain way or to retain something or have others see you one way or another. You're not corrupt. Actually, corruption is the opposite of reconciliation. It may not sound it, but the word corrupt comes from the Latin word cor, which means altogether, and rompere, which means to break. So to be corrupt is to break something that was formerly together. It is the opposite of reconciliation, which is to bring something together that was formerly whole. Corruption is the opposite of reconciliation. If we have an agenda about our feelings or our circumstances, then we're not free agents of reconciliation. We're corrupted by our agendas. So the work we do on ourselves is what begins our ability to do some good in the world. Now, obviously, we're not all going to be wandering around like enlightened masters all the time, but the very fact that we're doing the work and aspiring to reconcile ourselves to our lives qualifies us to begin the work with others. And this will bring opportunities our way. We just start from where we are, rather than thinking that we have to completely fix ourselves before we can do anything. It's a life's work. In fact, it is the work of life. And as we see the truth of what's within us, as we have compassion on ourselves, as we forgive ourselves and so become fully reconciled and realized, so we begin to see the truth that's around us and we can begin the work of compassion and forgiveness of all those around us so that the world might become more reconciled and realized through the work that we do. And that reconciliation in the world requires the same process as the inner reconciliation. We have to reconcile the truth of what's going on. Then we have to have compassion, and that leads to forgiveness and reconciliation. And almost the most difficult part is seeing the truth. It's interesting that the reconciliation between the two parties in South Africa required truth and reconciliation. Before anything could happen, the truth had to be identified first. But that's difficult in today's life, where truth seems subjective rather than objective. And one of the problems we have is the way society is beginning to break down and ghettoize truth, the idea that there are alternative facts. When the truth is hidden, then reconciliation cannot take place. And more world leaders are using the obfuscation of truth in order to control those in their power, because they know that truth will bring about the change that they don't want. The internet's shut down, social media stopped, and people are put in prison for speaking the truth. In this time of globalized communication, the power of truth in bringing about change is ever more visible. Leaders fear changes like the fall of communism, the Arab Spring, and other popular movements that have brought about change. And of course, with mass communications, that danger of change is ever greater and even more difficult to suppress once the genie is out of the bottle. But truth will out, and we can optimistically know that there is a flood out there, and leaders can only stand Canute-like before it and hope that they can restrain it by force. You can see this current crisis through the eyes of Lao Tzu, who wrote in 400 BC. He said, "When the Tao is forgotten, goodness and piety appear. When the body's intelligence declines, cleverness and knowledge step forth. When there is no peace in the family, filial piety begins. When the country falls into chaos, patriotism is born. In each case, when the truth is lost, then something has to replace it." I came across two quotes that really inspired me. The first was from William Blake, the English mystic, who wrote the Songs of Innocence and Experience and the hymn Jerusalem. And he said, "Truth can never be told so as to be understood and not be believed," which means that if the truth can be told so as to be understood, it will be believed. And the second quote was from Wittgenstein, "Whereof we cannot speak, therefore we must be silent." These two quotes sum up the dilemma we have in recognizing truth when we're speaking within the spiritual realm of absolute truth. And here we're approaching a truly enormous truth, the big elephant in the room, the truth that is so outrageous that it's ignored by those who take power and lead us. It is the truth that has Jesus say, "Love your enemies." It is the truth that has Gandhi and Dr. King espouse nonviolence. It is the truth that has the Tao Te Ching assert, "Let go of fixed plans and concepts, and the world will govern itself." It is the truth that all the great sages have realized and attempted to communicate. And yet it is ignored in the workings of humanity in the world. The realization of this truth would not only reconcile man to man and nation to nation, but also reconcile humanity to the planet and solve the existential climate change crisis. The only thing that's going to solve the problems of the world is the realization of this truth. And such a truth can only be understood through education. Education from educare, the Latin words, to draw out. The education required is to draw out of people the understanding that is deep within them. Once they understand this truth and they believe it, then the world will change. And what is this truth? It is the truth that all of the entire universe is one interconnected entity, and that humanity is a part of that entity. That we and the universe are one. That there is a unitarian nature to all consciousness and reality. That we are the universe made conscious of itself. We are the most advanced part of the evolution of that consciousness. Just as in the first axial age, when spirituality moved forward, which was 500 BC to about 500 AD, saw the emergence of Buddha, Jesus, Muhammad, and Lao Tzu, among others, bringing about the realization that there was a transcendent reality. That was the move that happened in that first axial age. There was a realization of a transcendent reality that was available to everyone. So now we're in the second axial age, which is characterized by the emergence of global consciousness and understanding that everything is intimately interdependent, that nothing exists in isolation from itself. that we are all connected, both on a surface level and at the much deeper level of consciousness. Everything is a part of the same consciousness that brought about and was manifest by the Big Bang, and is evolving through millions of years and many iterations to the point where today that consciousness is seeing and hearing and feeling itself through humanity, and is also aware of its origin and source. What we originally called God, we now see as an ordered urge towards aliveness that's evolving into a perfection that can be imagined but not fully understood. It is the truth of this understanding of the unitive nature of all things that's the solution to solving the problems that we have as a species here on our planet. To understand that we are all one, not just from a butterfly flapping its wings and causing a hurricane type of meaning, but also in the deeper connectivity of a unified consciousness expressing itself as all the different forms of matter and all the space that's between matter. That understanding is a game changer. It means that humanity has a duty to share all things for the betterment of that one reality, that all global problems need to be shared and solved together, that all global wealth is there for the betterment of all, not just for the few, that, as Isaac Asimov said, there are no nations, there is only humanity. And if we don't come to understand that right soon, there will be no nations because there will be no humanity. This concept of global human cooperation is the future, or we will not have a future. Now, you may think that this is all pie in the sky and that this will never happen, but the imperative of the bleak future that we're confronted with will drive the understanding that there has to be change. We probably only have a few generations to get there. Truth can never be told so as to be understood and not believed. If the truth can be told so as to be understood, it will be believed. And our role is to be able to tell this truth so that it can be understood. And if it is understood, it will be believed. Every iteration of godness has had the same challenge across the centuries. Whether it be the chariot god of the sun flying across the sky, or Moses and his Ten Commandments, people understood and they believed and they changed their lives accordingly, to the point that they often took to sacrificing their children to be reconciled to those gods that they believed in. Look at the Aztecs, and Abraham and Isaac. It was taken as truth, as was Christianity, the truth of Jesus coming from God to save all. His death so that humanity could be reconciled to God. More children killing, incidentally. And his resurrection, assumption, and us waiting for the second coming. That truth still exists today in the minds of many as being an absolute objective truth. It has guided the thinking of half humanity for the last 2,000 years. And now, with the evolution of our consciousness and understanding, we can see a truth that includes all religions. Religions are, I think, after all, a cultural interpretation of a truth. And that truth is the Unitarian nature of reality. Each of these truths has enabled humanity to progress as we've unpacked the implication of the truth as it's been interpreted. And the same is true of our current realization. It's not a final truth to say that the world is Unitarian in its nature. Like all other truths, it can't be seen as an objective reality. Just the nearest that our subjective realities can come to identifying with something that is objectively useful in the understanding of how best to live our lives. Our challenge is to communicate this reality in such a way that it can be understood and believed. But we have Wittgenstein ringing in our ears, whereof we cannot speak, thereof we must be silent. And to some extent, it is of the deep nature of things, of God, that we cannot speak, because we really don't know. As it says many times in the Bible, These things are too wonderful for us to know. In Islam, you cannot depict God or the Prophet. The Tao says, the Tao that can be told is not the eternal Tao. Whereof we cannot speak, we must be silent. To me, that means we have to speak with humility. For global reconciliation to take place, we have to see the truth, then have compassion, and then forgiveness. And that means communication with compassion and forgiveness in our hearts. But I do think that this truth of the unity of all things and our need to fully cooperate will have its day. There are no nations, there is only humanity. And if we don't come to understand that right soon, then there'll be no nations because there'll be no humanity. And I think the way that it will eventually come about is politically. I think that in all countries, people will begin to stand on a ticket of global citizenship. That slowly people will come together in different countries, people who see the need for a global approach, and will offer that approach to their electors. It'll start slowly and in small ways, but I think it will gain momentum. Gradually, those groups in different countries will come together, driven by the need to find global solutions. Electors will see the need for cooperation, and as people are elected on a ticket of global citizenship, so they will gain attention and recognition and finally unite as they come to power. I think this will happen. Our role on a spiritual level is to communicate the truth as we see it and humbly offer it as a way of education, of drawing out the understanding in those around us, so that the understanding becomes more widespread. So as the unity of all things is understood, it will be believed. It starts at a very practical level, that we have world problems, not national problems, whether that be global pandemics, climate change, or economic migration, or the refugee crisis. These are not problems that can be solved nationally. And we can see that. China's problems are our problems, and our problems are China's problems. And we can see that the current nationalistic aggression around borders that result in war is not serving either the human population or the planet. And to that end, we have to come up with some concept of global citizenship. It's there at the level of nations and at the level of the interdependence of all life. As Sogyal Rinpoche aptly put it in the Tibetan Book of Living and Dying, he says, "Nothing has an inherent existence of its own when you really look at it. Think of a tree. When you think of a tree, you tend to think of a distinctly defined object, and on a certain level it is. But when you look more closely at the tree, you'll see that ultimately it has no independent existence. When you contemplate it, you'll find that it dissolves into an extremely subtle network of relationships that stretch right across the universe. The rain that falls on its leaves, and the wind that sways it, the soil that nourishes and sustains it, all the seasons and the weather, moonlight and starlight and sunlight, all form part of this tree. As you begin to think about the tree more and more, you will discover that everything in the universe helps to make the tree what it is, that it cannot at any moment be isolated from anything else, and that at every moment its nature is subtly changing. That is what we mean when we say, things have no independent existence. That speaks to the physical independence of things. And we also have unity in consciousness, the experience that many of us have had, that all of this is of one whole, unified by a consciousness that pervades all matter. That consciousness is experienceable, and in the experience we find ourselves as part of a greater whole. That we are an expression of that greater consciousness, as is everything else in the universe. And in some way, that consciousness is ordering life in a way that we can participate and contribute to the evolution of that consciousness in our reality through the contributions made in the form of our loving presence. This is expressed in all the great religions. In Christianity, Paul puts it well in 1 Corinthians. And you can see the truth of the unity of things in Paul's statement. He says, just as the body, though one has many parts, but all its many parts form one body, so it is with the divine nature. If the foot would say, because I'm not a hand, I don't belong to the body, it would not for that reason stop being part of the body. If they are all one part, where would the body be? As it is, there are many parts, but one body. Now you are the body of the divine nature. Each one of you is part of that divine nature. That is the nature of the reality we exist within. And our role is to ensure that it's communicated and understood. Only this truth will see the reconciliation that the world needs to survive and evolve.